Hello and welcome to the Mindfield Pod with your hosts, Kiri and Alexi Pitalis. For those new to the podcast, we're two brothers on very different paths, looking into people's unique stories and how they've navigated their very own minefields. We're delving into the mental and personal challenges that they have faced and how they've got to where they are today. Many of the greatest achievers, impactors and creatives in our world have faced huge mental challenges and found a way to use them to their advantage. This first season features all sorts. We have the consultant psychiatrist for that expert opinion, the professional athlete turned entrepreneur, the serial startup founder, the influencer, the model, the actor, the artist, the NHS mental health professional, and even a pro wrestler turned life coach. We're attempting to understand the human mind that little bit better through real life stories and expert opinions. We're here to try and deepen the conversation around mental health. We hope you enjoy the pod. Please do subscribe, rate, and don't be afraid to get in touch, whether good or bad. Thanks for tuning in. Today we welcome Dr. Jeff Isaacs to the podcast. Jeff is a staff consultant at the Priory Hospital in North London. He previously worked in the NHS as a consultant psychiatrist for over 30 years, recently retiring from the NHS to focus on his two private practices in London and East Anglia. Jeff's special interests make him the perfect fit for the Mindfield Pod. His areas of expertise include mainly mood disturbances, anxiety, depression, bipolar affective disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and ADHD. Jeff assesses and treats all of these conditions in the community and hospital setting. His work also now includes the preparation of medico-legal reports, and he's instructed in around 50 cases annually, spanning criminal, civil, and family matters. Jeff, we're delighted you could join us today. Thank you for coming on board. I've given you a little introduction there, but maybe for the benefit of our listeners, could you give us a little bit more info and background as to how you got to where you are and how you became involved in the psychiatric space?
Yeah. My mum was a Samaritan, which meant that she helped people on the phone. So I grew up with that in the background. I then went to med school, became a doctor, worked in internal medicine, hospital settings, did some neurology. And that took me to Queen's Square, where I did some neuropsychiatry. And eventually I decided that psychiatry was the most fascinating part of medicine. And I could work with some of my medicine and deal with people using myself as primary tool. Sounds a bit strange, tool. But rather than using machines and investigations and what have you, just using one's own personality, it's been a fascinating career. I've enjoyed it and I'm still enjoying it.
Absolutely. And is there a big difference between working within the NHS and now working in private practice?
Not really. I mean, you're dealing with patients. You get paid for what you do in the private sector, whereas you get paid a salary in the NHS. Otherwise, I hope I give the same service to both sets of patients.
Absolutely. And you've been in this environment for quite a long time. You clearly have a lot of experience. And I think we're just interested in knowing, what are the biggest changes you've seen in the sort of, let's call it the mood disturbances space in over the 30 years, 40 years that you've been working there? Have things changed at all? Have things got worse? I mean, the reason I ask is nowadays mental health is a hot topic and it's part of the reason why we're here. And you hear about it a lot more than, say, you would have done 25 years ago. But for someone like you, I wondered if that's still the case.
There have been changes in different settings. So hospital wards have changed over the last 30 years. So 20 years ago, I was a clinical director in East Anglia, and I started off with 90 beds, various consultants in 90 beds. By the time I finished, 4 or 5 years later, we had, I think, 30 beds. In other words, we closed 60 beds, because that was the trend. And we had a lot of money, so money was pouring into the NHS, and we could set up lots of community services. And for a while, things looked very good. What happened was, I think we overshot, not just here, but all around the world. And we didn't have enough beds for the patients, and the wards became very disturbed places, because instead of having patients who were moderately ill, everybody was extremely ill, often detained under the Mental Health Act. And so there was no room for moderately ill patients, no space for them to recover. In the private sector, of course, it's slightly different because we have a much smaller percentage of detained patients, and there is still the opportunity for moderately ill patients to have space and time to recover. So that's changed. What else has happened? Clearly, there's been a greater awareness. there's been a change in social media and that kind of influence, so that there's been an enormous explosion, I would say, in the younger population, both presenting and suffering. So more people suffer, more people present, and services are overwhelmed. And there are problems in coping with the current workload. And it's not looking good moving forward.
Do you think there have been, with all this exposure, do you think there's been some kind of blurred lines within mental health and what it, say, means to be mentally ill or partly mentally ill or just be in a bad mood, for example? What do you kind of see as the main differences with all this exposure coming through?
I think there's two angles here. On the one hand, it's great that there's better awareness. It's great that there's an effort to destigmatize. It's great that people are coming forward earlier and getting help. On the other hand, society's changing as well. Family settings are not as robust as they used to be. Religion has taken a back seat. The materialism, the social media. So what's happening is there's less support. There's more geography. People are moving around more. Means less support. And sometimes problems, social problems, family problems, all sorts of issues are being medicalized. So on the one hand, there's certainly a lot of depression, and it's a major issue in terms of world economies and world suffering, world well-being, and there is medicalization of issues that used to be solved by better family settings, more religious import, you know, various issues that now come to the doctor. The GPs are overworked. They don't know their patients as well. They can't know their patients as well because there are the poly practices, which means that the GPs have 10, 12, sometimes luxury 15 minutes to see a patient, where the issue is not really medical. The issue could be sorted by knowing what's going on, by some intervention, but it's easier to give a drug or even a treatment. Even to give CBT is not necessary to give the right intervention, whereas maybe 30, certainly 50 years ago, Dr. Finley would have known the mother and the uncle and could have sorted the case out. Mm. Now it's going to be CBT or more recently Prozac, or, you know, predating the IAP CBT, which is sort of basic CBT, we would give more SSRIs. The other thing that's happening, of course, is that there's always been booze, there's always been drugs, but the drugs are getting nastier, some of them, and they disturb people more. And I'm just not quite sure where we're going. It's not we're talking at the time of Brexit and confusion and potential civil unrest. This is not an easy time for anybody.
No. Go on. Well, I was going to say, in practice, what is the most common thing you currently see or currently deal with?
I suppose somewhere between anxiety and depression. So a mood disorder that expresses itself differently in different age groups at different times. But the commonest thing I see, the commonest cause, is relationship difficulties that are expressed in the form of anxiety or depression. So what I'm really dealing with is relationship difficulties.
And to explain that a bit more, relationship difficulties between people?
Between people, so between family members, clearly husband and wife is a major issue,
yeah.
But between parents and children, older children, I don't deal with younger kids. But, you know, from youngsters not fitting in at school for various reasons, being on the spectrum, ADHD, or just not fitting into where we are currently with screen time and Facebook, Instagram, so on and so forth, right through to the older age group who are lonely, who don't have a role in their children's lives, who have nothing to do or don't have enough. They are living longer, but they're not necessarily healthy towards the end, and they can't do what they want to do. Life is very tough when you get to a certain age. And that's without the organic issues of Alzheimer's or such like.
Mm. And could you just explain a little bit more, because you are one of the more kind of more professional and more experienced that we've had on, but more in terms of CBT and how that works and how that can help certain people in particular, that type of therapy and kind of, I guess, how it all came about for you.
For me, CBT has a good scientific background. Seligman learned helplessness, whatever it was, 40 odd years ago, mm-hmm. 50 years ago. And it was developed, and there are different levels of CBT available for working in the NHS. And the government recognised this as necessary 25 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, and improved access to various psychotherapies, particularly CBT. And basically, CBT looks at changing negative cognitions, negative thoughts, negative behaviours. It looks at avoiding catastrophizing. It looks at making sense of where you are, holding some of the emotions until they settle. That's basically it. And that you do over prescribed courses. Health insurance companies like CBT, because unlike psychotherapy, dynamic psychotherapy, which is often open-ended, and analysis go on for years, CBT is formulaic, has courses, sometimes just 12 sessions or even less, and off, and is scientifically proven to work just as well as medication for most depressions. Not severe depression, but mild to moderate. It's better than medication. Medication, actually, mild to moderate depression isn't very good at all.
Right. And is that something that you wouldn't, I guess, subscribe or give to patients? Would you kind of stick away from the drugs that are offered at the moment? And do you see kind of that more, I guess, natural way of, or just as you said at the beginning, using your thoughts and your kind of process of CBT before any of that? Or would you still, for certain patients, is it a case that you might still give drugs to them, basically?
I think all problems of psychiatry can be addressed. Obviously, one has to make an assessment and diagnosis, but all problems are addressed in three different domains. Mm-hmm. There's medication, which is usually, apart from severe cases in psychiatry, not that relevant. There's therapy, and that's CBT primarily, and that's a very important part of treatment for many cases. But there's also lifestyle. There's the big issues in life, not just sleep, nutrition, exercise, mindfulness, well-being, but the reasons, often the relationships, the workplace, the attitude in the workplace, the relationship between the partners, the spouses, the parents, the children, that if you can deal with some of those real issues, then the need for medication is certainly reduced and often some can help. And CBT will be much more helpful. So CBT, if it's used as primary form of therapy, is good often at symptoms, but it doesn't address the causes of the symptoms. Most cases in psychiatry, not all of them, so not severe schizophrenia, not severe bipolar, not severe ADHD, but most issues have causes. There are reasons why people present the symptoms. And if you can address the symptoms, you're going to get rid of the symptoms. If you can address the causes, then you get rid of the symptoms. Mm.
Yes,
yeah,
very interesting.
You've touched on it, I think you might have touched on it just there, but we've talked a bit before as well on the podcast about the crossover between mental and physical health and actually the relationship between them. And I think sometimes it's not something you appreciate immediately, and you see them as two separate strands of healthcare. And I mean, how often do the people that you treat and the people that you look after, do you need to refer them maybe to someone to help them with their physical health or vice versa? Do people with initial physical health problems end up coming to you for their psychiatric help?
There's certainly a massive overlap, and certainly mood disorders can express as physical health problems. So if you take each field in physical health, often they will have a diagnosis that psychiatrists will consider that it might well be a psychiatric diagnosis. So if you look at urology, so chronic interstitial cystitis in women or chronic prostatitis in men is often seen as part of psychiatry because it's an expression of a symptom in a part of the body where often there are no findings. So for most conditions in medicine where there are no findings, fibromyalgia, there are no findings. So is the expression of pain or chronic fatigue syndrome, fatigue and pain, are they primarily psychiatric conditions? They certainly cause psychiatric symptoms, but are they actually expressions of psychiatric conditions? So the overlap is enormous. I'm not going to identify the patient, but I saw a patient who had various psychiatric diagnoses. She had fibromyalgia, she had so-called endometriosis. Which bit of that was organic and which bit was an expression of her mood disorder was difficult to know. Many people would say, look, if you've got very painful endometriosis, of course you're going to have depression. But not everyone who has some of the uterine lining in different parts of the body gets terrible pain all the time. They get it when they are depressed, frequently, or vice versa. So there's a massive overlap. Do I refer to physician colleagues? Yes, certainly when I'm uncertain, don't know what's going on. Do they refer to me? Frequently, yes. So irritable bowel will often come through to the psychiatrist because they're saying, we've done all we can, but there's no need for him to sit on the toilet for 2 hours a day, or whatever it might be. What else overlaps? I don't know. From premenstrual dysphoria or premenstrual syndrome through to menopausal symptoms, often you're going to have, certainly menopausal symptoms, someone presents with fatigue and cognitive impairment and depression and mood disorders, whatever, then actually HRT may be a very good treatment, and many other similar conditions. So there's an overlap, and we cross-refer, we cross-liaise. One of the advantages of the NHS in general hospital is you've got great relationships with your colleagues. In the private sector, it's a little bit more difficult, and of course, health insurance companies have to fund mutual reciprocal referrals.
That's interesting. Social media came up earlier, but I'm interested in your specific view. I mean, I really liked your contrast between the elderly generation who are suffering from potentially that not being exposed to enough and not having enough on and not having enough distractions, and contrast that with your younger generation who now have almost too much. And it's and it's this world that we live in where you really can't ever escape. And it breeds this sort of social fear that we don't have everything that we want and all of that sort of stuff. How often do you see social media? I mean, probably you're not going to say it to people flat out, but how often do you see it as a...
I see impact? Lots of issues with overload, information overload, screen time, distraction. That's not the same thing as social media, but just straightforward screen time is a massive problem. If you add into that young kids checking their Instagrams or Snapchats or checking their likes, the body image issues, the sleep disturbance issues, the general alienation from their peer, it's a massive problem. It's a big issue. And, of course, people describing all their symptoms, so their misery, their mood disorders, it produces lots of issues. I suppose predating social media, we had things like advertising Playboy centerfolds, getting smaller and smaller, body image, anorexia, bulimia. It's created by us. You don't have anorexia and bulimia in developing countries. It's only when they are westernized that these things develop, and as a direct influence of the perfect body, the perfect lifestyle. So now it's not just body image, there's the issues with exercise, male bodies, then there's issues with how much fun you're having. You know, how many kids are spending time taking enormous amounts of selfies, not enjoying their environment, hoping that someone will be impressed by what they're putting online. It's a major issue. And then just take it one stage further. How many people are now upset by their digital footprint? Things they've done, the relationships they've exposed. There are issues here that we don't know how to address yet. And that's not to take into account just from my digital stuff, gaming and gaming addiction. And
your job's getting harder and harder and harder.
It's getting varied. Very, very. You can't be knowledgeable about all areas, but you've got to be aware of all areas when you're assessing patients, because sometimes it comes in. So if I see an 18-year-old boy, girl, I've got to find out how they're living their life.
That was going to be my next question, because you touched on it. I think, is it that most of your questions end up being about the lifestyle and about kind of how lifestyle relationships, those sorts of things, are kind of more important than other things like symptoms and how long they're upset for, because that's where you're really going to understand the root of the problem. But I guess the main question is, how hard is it for you to get through to certain people to get them to actually give you the real reason? Sure. Because a lot of us are self-aware, but a lot of people think they're self-aware, but they might not be self-aware of the root of the problem.
Very good question, and very difficult to answer. I'm a white middle class male. So I'm not naturally accepted by everybody who I'm seeing anymore. Asking questions about the lifestyle is central. Patients want to tell me about the symptoms. I don't really want to know about the symptoms, because in a sense I see that as a reflection of the causes. And when I start trying to question about the causes, I'll give you a very graphic example. You know, a patient, male or female, will often say, yeah, my relationship's fine. And if you ask about sex, 35-year-old woman is saying, yes, my relationship husband's fine, he's lovely, sex is fine. And then if you ask, how often do you have sex? That's a very intrusive question. You've just met a strange man. And she says, well, I suppose we have it once every 3 months. you know, that's not kind of what you would expect in a healthy 35-year-old. Yes, she's got three kids. Yes, she's tired. Or yes, he's a... But so if you ask those kind of questions, you get a very different picture about what's actually happening. But you've got to find a way. And if I ask too much, too strong...
Away from a medical environment, it's very similar to the how are you. So you ask people, how are you? And the most common response statistically is, I'm fine. And I'm fine can mean so many different things. But then if you ask specific questions, just like you've said, you get into a whole nother level of detail. And
you don't want to, and you don't want to scare people away, because you know they probably do need the help if they are blocking that and they're kind of not willing to give that up, that sort of information.
Well, there's a delicate balance. And you also have to do private sector and public sector. Remember, people are paying to see me. So on the one hand, it would be much easier and better if I did an assessment slowly over three sessions. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
But if I'm too intrusive, I can find people away. Good child psychiatrists never do one assessment. But a good child psychiatry assessment can cost £1,500. Because they might do three or four assessments. That's a lot of money.
It's
a lot of money just to see a psychiatrist, but that's more than most of us charge, but a lot more than most of us charge. So there's a balance between being too intrusive, and it may come out very easily, or really frightening the individuals and they won't come back, and so on and so forth. So I don't get it right all the time, by any means.
No. But sometimes people, I guess, probably aren't ready to hear the truth or even know what might be the root cause of something, I guess.
Yes, I think, well, if you don't always want to know what the psychiatrist thinks is the root cause, because if you think there's no solution, then why identify that? So I saw a woman just today who has a very controlling husband. It was partly cultural, but she is no longer part of the culture that he's part of. He's very controlling. She's absolutely frustrated, but she's presenting with severe depression, even talking about suicide, because she can't stand living in that environment anymore. But she's frightened that he'll never change. So how do we give her the confidence to share that and then give her the confidence that something could be done? And I'm not sure something could be done because I've never met him.
Yeah, that's hard.
Do you often see patients, this is again, feel free to not answer because it's quite an intrusive question, but do you ever feel, not helpless, but in a weaker position than you'd want when you're trying to help patients, maybe a bit like that or that?
Do I ever feel that? Yes, is the answer. I can't always help certain people in certain situations, and that's very hard. Let's say somebody comes from a very rigid environment where there's just no wiggle room. They can't change anything, and they don't want to escape completely and abandon that environment. So it can be religion, it can be culture, it can be whatever it might be. It can be within marriage, it can be, and they can't escape. And there's no point in me giving them some hope that I can't possibly be realised. But at the same time, they could be desperate. I mean, to the point again of suicide. In psychiatry, suicide is seen by some patients as a solution, obviously.
Yeah.
It gets that bad. Moving towards, you talk a lot about relationships. How do you feel the relationship with that person's self does it play a big role?
What do you mean by that?
In the sense of how they feel about themselves, and the narrative maybe that's going on in their head. A lot of people talk about how they speak to themselves, and how we do all the time. How compared to, I guess, or not even compared, but any thoughts on that in terms of similar to the relationship type of conversation that we had?
Unquestionably, issues like self-esteem are paramount in terms of how people cope with the world. And that can change over time. I think one of the things you can't do, if we stick with self-esteem, is you can't actually build self-esteem in therapy very easily. You can begin to, but you need some validation eventually from the outside world. So it's got to be real to a degree. And I think people are often looking, they come with depression, and it's based on not feeling adequate, and there are experiences they've had that will make them feel inadequate. They can sometimes process or reprocess some of those traumas and move forward a little bit, but eventually they also need some validation in the outside world to move on enough to have no symptoms. So there's a relationship with yourself, but there's a relationship with yourself in the outside world where there's going to be some reciprocity that needs to be nurtured.
Yeah, that's great.
That's really interesting. Again, this might not be something that you can really answer, and I guess everyone is different, and everyone that you see is a completely different case. But you know, for someone out there who is suffering from severe anxiety, but from anxiety or moderate depression, I mean, what do you say to them? What are the easy tips for overcoming those sort of behavioural uncertainties and things like that?
Well, you're talking about symptom relief. So again, yeah. I would try and look at the cause, why that person at that time has developed the symptom they have. But if you're talking about just overcoming the symptoms, so there's basics like sleep, nutrition, exercise, well-being, mindfulness, meditation, those kind of things, through to CBT, through to, in severe cases, medication. But one needs to be careful of medication because it often is not going to cure anything. It's going to suppress numb symptoms. But the good thing about mood disorders is, like the common cold, most of them are self-limiting and don't last more than a couple of months. So you've got to be careful not to sort of jump on cases that are likely to resolve spontaneously, and not make more out of those than necessary. You have to identify the cases that need more input yeah. than basics. But what do you do if you're anxious? You look for support from your friends, you share it with close family. We're not talking about professional input. You look at your caffeine consumption, your Coke consumption, your chocolate consumption. You look at stuff that's basic. Yeah. And you also, you know, if you're unhappy in your job and you are getting anxious every time the boss walks through the door or somebody, you can look at why that's happening and sort of marry in with, is your appraisal okay? Are they respecting you enough? Are you being harassed? Are you not being harassed? And there are a lot of people that aren't comfortable for good reasons. And they need to sometimes try and adjust that situation. Everyone is an individual and everyone has different reasons. There are common themes. But I think you've got to look at each individual case and try and give advice that's specific to that case.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
As someone who's been in this field for a long time, do you find that often, it's a slightly different question, but do you find that often you get a lot of people that are friends and that are close to you seeking for advice, and sometimes it's harder to, is it harder or easier to give it to the people that you know?
Friends don't come for treatment. Mm-hmm. Friends usually come for advice
yeah.
or referrals, to be honest. That's how sure. it works. You know, I'm not going to intervene in a friend's marriage. That's not going to happen.
No.
Because you stop being a friend. You yeah. become a professional. But I would refer somebody on basic advice. We all give to each other all the time. So good friends do, don't they?
Yeah.
So I'm no better at it than anybody else.
I guess being there and yeah. listening.
Just being there, yeah, that's all I would do yeah. for a friend.
Slightly going more into it, because it is, I guess, what we're doing is more for people that have got mild to medium signs and to kind of curb the amount of people that are going into severe depression and anxiety. So I guess for our listeners, it's very helpful, like you said before, these certain tips and tricks. But if there's anything else that you can kind of think of that are good go-tos.
Ooh, I think common sense is important in yeah. all walks of life. So if someone's mildly depressed, yes, they've got to sleep. Yes, they should cut down on their booze. They shouldn't be taking drugs. They should get the right nutrition. They should get the right exercise. Those kind of things are good for it. Okay. What else can they do? They cannot immerse themselves in watching telenovelas at night, watching unpleasant things. The world's in a sorry state. You don't need to immerse yourself in bad stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. Some nice stuff. It's not a great example. I only watch rom-coms. Pathetic rom-coms that I enjoy. I often cry.
Yeah.
I have an interesting life. I mean, a lot of challenging situations. You asked about, you know, do I get upset about certain cases? Yes, I do. Hopefully I don't necessarily project that to the patient. But I don't need any more unpleasantness in life. So I'm not saying you shouldn't go on roller coasters or you shouldn't watch horror films, but you can do a lot by reducing the stress. You know, I see young professionals saying, I just feel terrible. When you last weekend, I went to Paris the weekend, next weekend I'm going to Oslo, and next weekend, and you go, well, when do you go for a walk on the heath? When do you pet your dog? Or when do you speak to your parents? Or there are different things you can do, simple things that are not going to make you better, but you're probably going to get better anyway. If you're not going to get better anyway, you're probably going to need help. So again, most mood disorders that are mild, are self-limiting, they remit spontaneously because of some reason. So if you had a tiff with your girlfriend, or the marriage isn't going well, and you just need to invest a bit more time. We can all be nicer, more thoughtful, more respectful. That's not what's happening politically at the moment, we know, but you know, we could all behave better, and that would help a little bit. What else? You know, I think sport's great. I think team games are important. I think camaraderie, keeping up with old relationships that are positive, all that kind of stuff really works for mild mood disorders. It's a bit more when you get onto the moderate, the medium thing, and when you're in the severe end, you're going to need help. The moderate, it depends whether you hit over a certain threshold, how resilient you are, whether you, as you get older, and I'm very old now, I kind of, when you're in a bad mood, you've been there before, you might not even be able to solve the problem because as you get older, there's lots of problems, but you kind of know that it's going to come good because you've had that experience. Yeah. So you can just hold on sometimes. I'm not saying everyone should hold on, but you can. When you're young, you don't know that. You don't know when the anxiety is going to finish. Is it going to end up in you freezing or collapsing or whatever it might be? It gets...
The first time is always scarier, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I guess just to finish from me, as someone that has helped people for most of your life, for anyone that knows someone that might be struggling, I guess, what are your best bits of advice on how to approach that person as a friend, as someone that knows them maybe better than others?
As a friend, I think you say, how are you doing? What's happening? And they may fob you off. If they fob you off, you say, well, you just don't look right to me. You just don't sound as if things are going well. What's happened? Let's go for a drink. You wouldn't drink too much. Let's go for some drink. Let's go for a walk. Let's see what's happening. And then you help them. You know, so if things are tough, yes, you can advise them to the doctor. You can advise them to speak to whoever is closer to them, their relationship, whatever. It's not that difficult to get involved. I think we've mostly probably always been, we've always had experiences where we've helped somebody, both when we're kids in school, 14, 15, 16. If it's serious, you know, if they say life doesn't feel like it's worth living, then you've got to act pretty quickly. You've got to push a little bit harder. You've got to allow yourself to be intrusive. And you might say, well, people don't want you to do that, you know. They will tell you and you'll have to make a decision on that, on those grounds.
Okay. No, that's great.
The only other thing I wanted to cover was, do you see a lot of young people struggling with the weight of exams and the weight of pressure that comes with all that? I know we talk about our young being over-examined and over-tested all the time, and everything is a test. And then when you're out of tests, you're still thinking about those tests that always seem to be around the corner. And do you deal professionally with young people who suffer from those?
The answer is yes, I deal with those people. And the answer also is that part of the answer is that I, you know, did my GCSEs, O-levels, A-levels, all sorts of exams. I still have night sweats about my A-levels because they were tough. They were for everyone, all of us. What do? You can't... There are different systems on there. We tried coursework. We tried this. We tried to reduce pressures. Expectations are enormous on everybody. We've got, 50% of the population going to university, maybe probably less now because they can't afford it or things are changing. It's tough. Yes, if you're lucky and you have support and you keep your nutrition and your sleep and you do all the right things, you do your revision schedule on time, you're going to deal with it better. But remember, it's equipping you for life. So it is a very positive experience. I have two grown-up boys, sons. I was happy they struggled during exams. It's made them more resilient. So there's a positive aspect as well. You don't want to sail through things. One of the worst experiences is being somebody for whom life is a breeze. And then when you fall, age 25 or 32 or whatever it might be, you fall really hard and you have no experience of having suffered and having regained your stability. That's quite tough. So there are positives in suffering, provided you get through it.
Yeah.
Well, that's hit the nail on the head of why we're doing this podcast. That's exactly the kind of, not message that we're trying to push, but trying to see through, in the sense that sometimes things have to be hard for them to, you know, for you to improve, for you to get better, for you to be more resilient. So thank you very much for coming on and for answering all those questions so honestly. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. Cheers. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Mindfield Pod. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and get in touch. We all have our own minefields, and we hope that this podcast goes some way to helping you navigate yours.